Okay, I'm very, very pleased to introduce Paul Hepke from the University of Washington, who's going to tell us about moduli spaces of complex surfaces.
Thank you very much for the invitation. So, as I said in my abstract, lots and lots is known about the moduli space of curves, and actually not very much is known about the moduli space of surfaces in general. So I want to sort of survey what's known and point out some interesting problems and some things that are known. Okay, so let me begin by reminding you about the situation for curves, or more generally just classifying algebraic varieties in general. So if we classify algebraic varieties, I will always consider algebraic varieties as complex numbers, and if you rather, you can think of these as complex manifolds. Basically, my point of view is that almost all complex manifolds are algebraic varieties. So, okay. So there's two parts, a discrete part, so topological invariants. And a continuous part. So this is what's called the moduli space. So moduli spaces of varieties with given invariants, with fixed numerical invariants. So let's sort of see how this goes for curves. So perversely, algebraic geometers call curves what everyone else calls Riemann surfaces. So it's quite easy. So first of all, the discrete part, there's just one topological invariant. So it's a unique topological invariant, which is the genus, or number of handles. So if you draw your Riemann surface, there's just one topological invariant, which is how many holes has it got. And the second part, much more interesting. So the moduli space of curves of genus G. So let's call it MG. Is a complex orbifold of dimension 3g minus 3. So this is essentially known to Riemann. Okay. So let me say a little bit about what I mean by, so what's a complex orbifold? It's just like a complex manifold, except instead of being locally modeled on Cn, we actually mod out by a finite group. Okay, so yes, extremely nice space, and it's been studied in a wide variety of areas of mathematics. So one other thing I should say immediately is this is not a compact complex manifold, and this is basically because smooth curves can degenerate to singular ones. So in this sort of picture, if I have a smooth complex curve, pick any loop, any sort of embedded S1 on the curve, so for instance this one, then you can find a degeneration where that circle is collapsed to a point. And so it becomes a union, a sort of one-point union of two Riemann surfaces of lower genus. Just crush this vanishing cycle. To a point. Okay. And so a very nice theorem due to Deline and Mumford. In the 60s. Was that just sort of basically consider all the ways that this can happen, you get a compactification of MG. So there's a compactification. With the following properties. So first of all, it has a geometric meaning. The points at the boundary parameterize this type of generation. So such that the points at the boundary correspond to singular curves. So let me say exactly what those curves are. So first condition is that the singularities are the sort of singularities you see here. So singularities are what are called nodes. So in equations, that's just x, y equals 0 inside C2. And second property is a sort of stability condition. And the quickest way to say this is that the automorphism group of the curve is finite. And this is often stated sort of more explicitly. So explicitly, whenever I have a P1 inside C, a rational component, there are at least three nodes, so at least three mark points. Nodes. So you have to kill the automorphism group of P1 by marking at least three points. So that's one reason this is a very nice space, that it has this geometric interpretation. And the second reason, so also, this is basically the same sort of space as MG. So in other words, MG bar is a complex orbifold. And if you look at the boundary, so just remove the locus of smooth curves, this is a normal crossing device here. So that means just, again, in this local model, it looks like a product of coordinates equals 0 inside C to the n mod g. So these are just some of the coordinates on this Cn. Okay. Well, let me say one more thing about MG, which is another very nice property. So finally, components of the boundary. Are just indexed by all the topological types of degenerations of this sort. So indexed by topological types of degenerations. So it will be a codimension 1 degeneration if we just crush one curve. So there are two different types. So we could do this sort of thing we did before and crush a curve that's actually homologous to 0. So crush an S1 that's homologous to 0, so you get a union of two components of lower genus. Or you can take a curve that's non-trivial in homology and get a sort of... pinched curve of genus G minus 1. So there's this beautiful inductive structure on these moduli spaces. So here, this boundary component will be just exactly MG1 with a marked point. So that will be denoted MG1, 1. So this means curves of genus G1 with one marked point. So these are genus G1 and G2. And this will be just, again, so a moduli space of curves of genus G minus 1 with two mark points.
So there's this very nice stratification of the boundary into these components, which you can understand in terms of cursive lower genus. And I think Grothendieck once called this Lego type more. So you sort of think of building it up like a Lego. Okay, so that's pretty much the most basic things about MG, and it's an extremely nice space and lots of applications. And now I want to talk about the case of surfaces. So here, I mean, by contrast, almost nothing is known. So what about complex surfaces? So let's go back to my two pieces. So first of all, the discrete part. So even this is not known. So let me first say, though, that everything is known except in the case of what are called surfaces of general type. So everything known except for so-called surfaces of general type. Actually, just occurred to me when I was discussing MG, I should have said genus at least 2. So if genus is 0 or 1, the space doesn't really make sense as I defined it. But so here, really, so MG, I just say, we like to restrict to G at least 2 because then the automorphism group FC is finite. So similarly, surfaces of general type, it's a similar condition. It basically corresponds to requiring the genus is at least 2 for curves. But let me say precisely what it is. So if X is my surface, and then I look at the a line bundle on X, which is just the what's called the canonical line bundle. So in other words, the sections are holomorphic two-forms. So the top holomorphic forms. then I can consider the map I get to projective space by taking all sections of this line bundle, or rather some power of that line bundle. So it's a map to projective space, let's say PM, given by all sections of this line bundle. Right, so whenever I have a line bundle, a bunch of sections, I get some mapped projective space, possibly not everywhere defined. So then what does it mean to be general type? So X is general type if this map, let's call it, say, phi n. If phi n is an isomorphism, is birational for sufficiently large n. So roughly speaking, it says there are lots and lots of differential holomorphic differential forms on X of top degree.
Okay.
Let me also add at this point, so if in this situation, so what we can look at is if X bar is the image of X, so that's actually embedded in this projective space by some power of the canonical line bundle. So then this is a very reasonable object to study in instead of just studying X. So this has nice properties, namely that then this line bundle on X bar is ample. It's some power is gives an embedding, just by definition almost. And the second thing, which may be a little less obvious, is it has nice singularities. So it has so-called ADE singularities. These are pretty mild singularities, and for most purposes, it's better to work with X bar than with X. Any questions? Okay, so I was going to tell you about these numerical invariants here. So the key invariants for surfaces. Well, the Chern numbers. So C1 squared, or if you're an algebraic geometer, Kx squared. That'll be a positive number. And C2, in other words, the Euler number, are the main invariants. And then also the fundamental group that maybe... maybe I'll concentrate on these two for the moment. So it's not known which of these can occur. So there are some general results. So for instance, there's the Yau inequality. Which gives you this inequality on the Chern numbers. And then so we have some Noether inequality. This is a Max Noether. Some lower bound on C1 squared in terms of C2. And one more, which is just a congruence condition. So that C1 squared plus C2 should be congruent to 0 mod 12. So there are some general restrictions on the Chern numbers, but it's not known exactly which can occur for a surface of general type. So you might think at this point, we don't even know which topological types occur. It might seem a little... premature to be studying the moduli space. But actually, one of the things I want to point out in this talk is that if you think about the moduli space and you look at sort of generations in the moduli space, then it is actually possible to construct examples of smooth surfaces of general type with given topological invariants by smoothing singular ones. So the point of view of the moduli space is actually useful even to show the existence of the the smooth guys. So let's leave discrete invariants for a moment. I should say perhaps this whole subject of trying to construct or trying to understand what possible Chern numbers occur is called the geography of surfaces, and there are some general results, but I'm not going to spend much time discussing them.
What to fix if you want to be connected, or
sorry?
You know which things to fix to make it connected?
Oh no, I mean that's also an extremely... So for MG, is a very nice theorem that it's just connected, for a given genus. That's not known yet. Maybe I'll just start talking about the moduli space. If you fix C1 squared and C2, you can actually have arbitrarily many connected components. Yeah. So let's talk about moduli. Ooh, where am I? So there's continuous parts of the classification. Okay, so we're going to fix C1 squared and C2. So then there is a moduli space. Let's call it M of surfaces in general type. With C1 squared and C2. What I mean by there exists. So it's pretty nasty in general. So here's the warning, which is, so first of all, it may be highly singular. So it may be highly singular. And this is even before I start considering singular surfaces, just for smooth surfaces. It's certainly not always a complex manifold. And as Sean just mentioned, it may not be connected, so it may be disconnected. But at least there are finitely many components. Okay. Let me also mention the compactification. So there is a compactification. This is due to Collard and Schäfer-Baron. which is analogous to the compactification for MG. In the sense that it parameterizes singular surfaces. So M bar, let V be the boundary, parameterizes singular surfaces. So let me say a little bit about what sort of surfaces you might see at the boundary of this space. So there's two conditions again. So on the singularities, it's what's called, I'll give you the name, but feel free to ignore it. It's called semi-log canonical singularities. And let me just give you some examples. So this includes, the two-dimensional version of singularities of curves. So namely, we take x, y equals 0 now inside C3. So just two smooth surfaces meeting along a curve. quotients. So quotient singularities. So in other words, C2 modulo finite group. And there'll be worse singularities also, but these give the flavor of what sort of thing to expect. And it's always the case that if you look at away from a finite number of points on the surface, the worst thing you can have is this normal crossing behavior that we saw for curves. So in the second condition, the stability. So if you remember for curves, I said the stability condition was just that the automorphism group is finite. And that can be rephrased also for curves in the following way. You just say that the canonical line bundle on the curve is ample. So this line bundle we have is a positive line bundle. I'm writing omega x here for the thing that on the singular variety would correspond to the canonical bundle if it were smooth. But you have to be a little bit careful about how you define this. So what is this really? It's really what's called the dualizing sheaf. So it's not quite the canonical line bundle. But the way to explain it is that if I have a component of x, and I restrict this bundle to y, what I'll get is the canonical bundle of y twisted by the double locus. So here, delta is the double locus, the locus of curves where we have two components meeting, so that's a divisor. And this will mean, so what will this be? This will be holomorphic two forms which have poles along delta. So poles along delta. So if you've seen the thing for curves, you maybe you're already familiar with this sort of thing. But anyway, so we have some line bundle on the surface, and we require that to be ample. Anyway, as I said, for curves, if you write down the same definition, you get exactly the usual Deligne-Mumford stability condition. I lied slightly again. this will not be a line bundle. So omega x is a Q line bundle in the sense that some power is a line bundle. So omega x tensor n is a line bundle for some n. So this is very typical of a situation with quotient singularity. So you have, what you really have is you have a line bundle on the cover, and the group may act by a non-trivial character on that line bundle. So in order to kill that character and descend to the quotient, you need to take a power of the bundle. Okay. All right. So I wanted to mention one nice fact about this space that we do know. There aren't very many. So it is true, and it's due to Collar, that this space is projective. So I should say scheme instead of variety, but hopefully that won't scare anybody off. because it's got quite complicated singularities. how would one actually prove such a statement? It's actually a very, very nice proof. So what you do is you just write down the line bundle. So the line bundle, roughly, so we have some family over the moduli space, universal family. Let's say P is the projection onto the moduli space. You just take the push forward of the relative omega. So differential forms on the fibers take some appropriate power, so it's a large power. That will be a vector bundle on the moduli space. Just take the determinant of the vector bundle. So in other words, i.e. the fibers, so fibers of this line bundle are just top wedge of global sections of omega on the fiber. So UT. You're sufficiently large, yeah.
Wouldn't you have to do a congruence?
I think it's okay, but maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. The basic reason. Let me just say, why should this define an ample line bundle? It's basically why is this ample? And the basic answer is it basically comes from Hodge theory. So Griffiths theory of variation of Hodge structure. Basically, what's going to be true is this line bundle is pulled back. This is the case n equals 1. So I'm going to give it a vague idea why this is true. So if you look at n equals 1, what we know is that if we look at the global sections of omega, so let's just look at a smooth surface. That's just this part of the Hodge structure inside H2. And now Griffiths showed that these things have the correct curvature conditions. So curvature computation shows that the vector bundle we get is non-negative. So it doesn't show it's got an ample determinant, but at least it's non-negative. So that's an idea about why such a thing might not be true. And then if you just sort of figure out the details, that you really do get an ample line bundle in all cases. Any questions? Okay, so I wanted to say a little bit about why is M singular? why do we get this nasty behavior? And so I just wanted to briefly review the sort of way to think, one way to think about complex deformations of a complex manifold. So let's say that X is a complex manifold. And let's cover X by some complex balls. Okay, so we have some picture like this. And this is the patch of my X, and let's call this UI, UJ, and UK. So this is basically the Kodaira-Spencer theory or Grothendieck's reworking of that. The first statement is if you look at H1, so the first cohomology group of the tangent bundle, holomorphic tangent bundle of X, this can be computed as a Czech cohomology group for this open covering. And if you just, you can really just see in coordinates that this is actually going to give you the first order deformations. So maybe I should say, if you're not an algebraic geometer, what I really mean is like the tangent space to the space of deformations of X. So all deformations of X will be parameterized by some space, possibly singular, and this is computing its tangent space at the mark point corresponding to X. So why is that in terms of this picture? So what is such a if I give myself some class in here, let's call it sort of GIJ. What is it giving me? So this will be, so GIJ here will be a section of the tangent bundle over the overlap UI intersect UJ. it's sort of a a vector field on the overlap that's telling me how to change the gluing of these balls. And so similarly, I'll have vector fields on the other double overlaps. And the co-cycle condition is exactly the compatibility on the triple overlap. So it gives me a compatible gluing. So that's what a co-cycle in here gives me, just a way to change the gluing in a compatible way. And the so H1 is a quotient. So what are we quotienting by? We're quotienting by reparameterization of the UIs. So if you just write down the definition of this check cohomology group, you'll see that it really is parameterizing just different ways to change the gluing of these patches. Okay, so that's the tangent space, and what's the meaning of the second cohomology group? This contains obstructions. To lifting deformations to higher order. So what that means is, suppose I have such a deformation given by some GIJs, so given a first order deformation, let's lift GIJ arbitrarily to, say, GIJ tilde. So this will be a gluing of UI and UJ, gluing on the overlap of UI and UJ to order 2. So this gives me an order 1 gluing, and this is an order 2 gluing. So then what will happen is the co-cycle condition will no longer be satisfied. So what I want is that GIJ, I guess I want to think of GIJ as going from I to J. So GIK should be GJK GIJ. So that's true at first order by construction. We took a one co-cycle. But when we lift to second order, this will not be true in general. So this fails. what's the obstruction to fixing this? So if I change the lifts, then I will be able to make this work, provided the class of this term in H2 is 0. So let me just write that down. So we can fix if the class of this guy, so GIJK tilde inverse composed GJK tilde. This will define a 2 co-cycle in here. This is 0. Okay. So that's the sort of general picture for deformations of complex manifolds. And let me sort of say, I mean, I'm not going to give a full proof of it, but basically what this gives you is that you get the deformation space of X is given. First of all, it's a closed subvariety of this space H1TX, so just complex vector space of some dimension, and it's given by at most the dimension of H2x equations. So in particular, it's smooth if HDTX is zero. Okay, why did I go through all this? So one is to say, why is it not a surprise that for curves we get smooth deformation spaces? It's just precisely because for a curve, H2 is always zero. Now, on the surface, of course, one shouldn't expect H2 to be zero in general. So H2TX is zero for curves by dimension. But for surfaces, typically, it's non-zero. And actually, it's even worse than this, because if you just think about, if we actually have a surface of general type, H2T, you see, Visere duality will be a twist of the holomorphic one forms by the canonical bundle. And this is assumed to be ample. So, and then we're taking global sections. So we really, really, most of the time, we should expect this to be non-zero. So very often, not equal to zero for general type. This is search quality. Okay. Perhaps I should emphasize, though, this fact here. If you know H2 is zero, it doesn't automatically guarantee that the thing is singular. The first lower bound you would write down for the number of equations, the first upper bound you write down for the number of equations is non-zero. So it certainly can be the case that H2T is non-zero, but nonetheless you get smooth deformation space. So that's the basic reason why these spaces are singular for surfaces. So I want to address the following question. So what are the boundary components of this compactification in bar? So I guess for this discussion to make any sense whatsoever, I'm going to assume that we have some component of M that's reasonably nice. So, maybe it's a irreducible variety and it's got mild singularities. So what I'm thinking is the boundary then should be something like what we saw for MG. It should be a divisor. We want to enumerate the components of that divisor. Okay, so I don't have a complete answer, but let me give you two main cases. So the first case is the Lefschetz, so the classical generation. So here we just have, basically like for curves, we have a vanishing cycle. So there's going to be some cycle, which is an S2, which gets crushed in the generation. So this is, you can imagine this is just a quadric surface generating to a quadric cone. That's what it looks like locally. So this singular point is just of this type. So that's the well-known classical case. But there's another case that's much less well-known. So this is, maybe I'll call it Weil degeneration. So Jonathan Weil. I think was the first to study these in the 80s. So this is another thing that happens in codimension one, and it's not particularly well known because it's not a complete intersection. It lives in a higher has high embedding dimension. So what are the what's the situation here? So I'll tell you what the local model is. So we have we'll tell you a one-parameter family, let's call it script X over the disk, and the special fiber, let's call that Roman X. So the local model is that this script X is given by one equation in a in an ambient space that itself is a quotient singularity. So it's contained in C3 XYZ modulo Z mod NZ across the disk. So T is the coordinate on the disk. And the group action is just to take XYZ. So it's going to act diagonally on XYZ with some characters. It just sends it to Z to X, Z to inverse Y, Z to the AZ. And A is just some number co-prime to N. Okay. So in particular, this X, the special fiber, will be a quotient of a hypersurface singularity. And it turns out that actually, just to do a quick calculation, you'll find this is actually a quotient singularity itself. This is actually a quotient singularity by Z mod n squared Z. So U and V here, X to the N. Oops, let me get this right. The other way around. So X is U to the N, Y is V to the N, Z is UV. So this is the other type of other main type of codimension 1 degeneration. So let me just say a little bit about why is this codimension 1? You see, because here, let's just forget about the group action for a moment. If I take the singularity x, y equals z to the n, then that has many deformations, right? So this is for those that know, it's an an minus 1 singularity, and all the deformations you just get by adding on powers of z, so you get a whole slew of deformations. But if we want to preserve this group action, there's only one possible choice. So this is the only one that's invariant for the group. That's why we get a codimension 1 component. So there's only one deformation parameter of the quotient. So I think it's an extremely interesting question to determine the degenerations of this type that occur if you start with a given smooth surface of a general type. That's not known. So problem. So enumerate the Val degenerations of a given surface. So you see, in the first case, if you want to enumerate Lefschetz degeneration, somehow you have this natural thing to look at. You have the vanishing cycle, so that's some element in H2 of the general fiber. Let's call it Y. And delta squared is minus 2. So you have this class in the cohomology that predicts the existence of this degeneration. In this case, it's much less clear. But actually, I'm giving a talk on the Thursday, so my talk on Thursday, I'll discuss how this is related to actually vector bundles on smooth fiber. So it seems that it might be possible to understand the enumeration in terms of vector bundles on the smooth fiber. Okay. Let me mention one application. So application, and this is something I mentioned before. So this was due to Lee and Park in 2007. They constructed a new example of a surface of general type. Via one of these Val degenerations. So let me tell you, the invariance, it was, so k squared is 2, and, let me say it this way. So if you look at the second Betti number, it's exactly one positive direction in H2, and pi 1 is 0. So it was a long-standing open question whether such a surface existed. So which asserts the general type. And they proved it using this sort of typology generation. So let me just give you an idea of the proof. So what they did was they wrote down a rational surface. I keep the same notation here. So it's rational surface X with Weyl singularities. Such that, so this is going to sound kind of bizarre, but such that the canonical divisor of X is ample. And so if you have a rational surface, you have a smooth rational surface, of course there are no sections whatsoever of any power of the canonical bundle. But it is possible to write down a singular rational surface where this bundle is actually ample. And the point is, if you were to pass the resolution and you look at these sections, all these sections of K that you've constructed, they would have poles along the exceptional locus. So this is possible, although, you know, it's slightly surprising. And then, so that's the first step. And this is this uses sort of elliptic vibrations. It's a rational elliptic surface. Perhaps I should mention that also, this is related, so there were the two authors, Park, actually is really a symplectic geometer, and he had made a similar construction in sort of the context of, Seiberg-Witten theory before they came up with this algebraic construction. And secondly, so now we just have to prove this surface smooth. So we show H2Tx equals 0. What that means is that there exists a smoothing of X. I told you that if you had a smooth surface, H2T measures, if H2T is 0, that will tell you that the deformation space is smooth. Now, if I have a singular surface, H2T also performs another function. If H2T is 0, what it means is that I can globalize any local deformation of the singularities. So any deformation of the singularities globalizes. So you can do it by a sort of similar sort of thing to what I was saying, just see what the obstruction would be by just gluing patches together. So there's a smoothing of X, and then finally they sort of compute. I mean, obviously they chose X in an appropriate fashion, so compute topology of the smoothing using sort of a Milner fiber. Okay, so that's the basic strategy. Okay. So I wanted to discuss some examples. It's sort of embarrassing, you know, because there aren't very many. There aren't very many good examples. Let's see. I think it would be stupid to give a talk about moduli of complex surfaces without mentioning K-free surfaces. So I'll just say there's a very nice theory for K-3s. So this is the case where, so here now, the canonical bundle is just trivial, and it's simply connected. So I there are many places you can read about this, so I won't say anything more about K-free surfaces, except it's an extremely nice theory. So let's talk about something else. So these cases I just mentioned. So if we look at the case where there's just one positive eigenvalue on H2, and the fundamental group is 0, let's say for simplicity. And I'm also considering now general type. This was kind of a blip. I just wanted to mention that K-3s are very, very nice, but they're not general type, of course. Okay, so what can we say in this case? So actually, it follows from these assumptions work of Michael Friedman? Friedman, anyway, in the 80s. This will be homeomorphic to a rational surface. And not just a rational surface, a Del Pezzo surface. So all you have to do is just compute what the intersection form is, and then Friedman's result does all the work. So it's just a blow up of n points in P2, where n is at most 8. Oh, sorry, or P1 cross P1. And perhaps I should also mention that it's never diffeomorphic, so not diffeomorphic. So it's known now that the Kodaira dimension is a diffeomorphism invariant. So. Okay. So these are very interesting surfaces. So they're homeomorphic to a Del Pezzo, but nonetheless they're general type. But there aren't that many examples known. The first one is called the Barlow surface. That was Rebecca Barlow was a student of Miles Reed in the 80s. So this is the case where k squared is 1. And this Lee and Park example I just mentioned in 2007, with k squared equals 2. So why am I mentioning these surfaces? I thought since I was in Austin, I should mention. I think an extremely interesting question is, what is the derived category? So what is the derived category of X? In many ways, it's very similar to a Del Pezzo surface, where we know everything we could possibly want to know about the derived category. And I think it seems to me that actually, so I guess the sort of general philosophy about derived categories is the derived category of a surface of general type will be extremely nasty. It'll be extremely just way too big to understand. But I think in these cases it may actually be accessible. I'll also mention in my talk tomorrow that one can construct so-called exceptional objects in these derived categories. So so that also sort of bodes well if you want to try and describe the thing explicitly. Okay, so that was. Those are some surfaces of general type. There is special surfaces of general type, but certainly of interest. Or perhaps I should also mention here the dimension of the moduli space, or at least the expected dimension of the moduli space. So that will be H1 of T minus H2 of T. This is just topological, you see. This is just the same as the Euler characteristic of T, minus the Euler characteristic of T. So that's topological. Computed using Riemann-Roch. So it would be the same as for the Del Pezzo. So that's 2n minus 8, where rho, or B2, is 1 plus n. Okay. So the final thing I wanted to discuss is so-called surfaces on the NERFA line. So this is an old result of Horikawa. So very, very roughly, I won't tell you exactly what the NERFA line is. Basically, things that satisfy where the NERFA inequality that I wrote down earlier is actually an equality. So, but roughly, C1 squared is minimal for given C2. That's basically what's happening. So here, Horikawa, I think I. Maybe he was a student of Kodaira. I'm not actually sure. But anyway, Horikawa in the 70s, 75, basically gave a complete classification of these surfaces. and so let me just give an example. So here we'll take a C1 squared to be 5 and C2 to be 55. So this is just the... let's also say that it's essentially simply connected. So this is the numerical type of a quintic surface in... E.g. quintic surface. So that's somehow the simplest, the first surface of general type you'd write down, right? So write down a hypersurface, which is sufficiently high degree to be a general type. So nonetheless, Horikawa discovered quite an interesting thing about these surfaces. So that says then the classification of Horikawa was the following. So it's either a quintic surface, or... if you have a quintic surface, what is this map given by? This map is just given by the canonical. Right. So omega is just O1 on that P3. what could possibly go wrong? Do the same thing for an arbitrary surface, these numerical conditions. What happens is that you pick up a base point. So actually what happens is you have a blow-up It's a simple blow-up. To make the map given by omega regular. And then that does map to P3, but it lands in a quadric, some quadric in here. And this is a 2-to-1 map. And there are two cases, so cases A and B, where Q is either smooth or singular. Okay. And so then the very nice thing about the moduli space that Horikawa found out was this. But if you look at the moduli space, it looks like this. There's two pieces. These are the surfaces of type 1. These are the surfaces of type 2A. And these are the surfaces of type 2B. And if you look at this point, it really is like literally like xy equals 0 inside C41, which is H1 of T of this surface. So that's one example of a description of these moduli spaces. I should stop. So thank you very much.
Questions? In this case, what's the dimension of the moduli space? When there was 2n minus 8, I was wondering, is it rational also?
So it's not known in all cases, but I think it's typically rational, yeah.